From KCUR News, this is KC Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, we look at how teaching has changed in some Kansas City classrooms over the past few years.
Yes, 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 yes.
Class, class, class.
Yes, yes, yes.
Class, class.
Yes, yes, yes.
Class.
Yes, yes, yes.
And a local pastor becomes a national advocate for gay rights in the Presbyterian Church.
I don't recall any more meaningful days of ministry than these past few days. The church has really been, for me, everything the church is supposed to be.
Plus, tune into some Kansas City cumbia. It's KC Currents. Listen up, just after this hour's newscast. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Missouri lawmakers took a pass on changing the governance structure of the Kansas City Public Schools this year. That means the school board and their chosen superintendent still have until June of 2014 to improve students' academic performance before the state can take over. To many, that sounds like two more years of the status quo.
But school officials say they're continuing to implement a transformation plan set in motion by the previous superintendent. Until the end of the school year, that plan included a radical new approach to teaching called student-centered learning. The current administration had kept that program running in 10 schools, but this summer has decided to put the program on hold. Back in February, I went to see student-centered learning in action at Faxon Elementary. Beverly Dunn's classroom was buzzing. The 9 and 10-year-olds were clustered in small groups around the room, each group working on a different project.
This group, they're writing. They're writing a story. They can help each other with words and stuff and sometimes getting ideas. This group is working on a program called Success Maker. It's on their netbooks, and it's a program where they take a test, and then computerized knows what they need help in, and that's the kind of things they give it, and then they give games, so it makes it kind of fun for them, too. This group is writing summaries, and then this group is we've been working on prefixes and suffixes, so they're playing a game where they're putting the prefixes with the base word, and then they're coming up with their own words, too.
Dunn knows she has a range of levels in her class. Most students are not at the grade level they should be, according to their age. So she set up these activities for each of the students to work on the areas where they need help.
We have basically just all the words that are over here. We have repaint, unhappy, return, revisit, rewrite, unlock, misspell. We have
Cameron Jenkins is working with two other girls to add prefixes and suffixes to root words.
Reset, return, unlock, resmell, unhappy.
Cameron doesn't think of herself as a fourth grader.
I'm level 12 in reading and level 9 in math.
She started at Faxon 2 years ago when it reopened with a new program that grouped kids according to the academic level they were at, not what grade they're in. Cameron thought it was pretty weird.
Because every school year, you would think that a kid would just go through grades and grades and grades and grades, except in this grade, there is no grade level. It's an instructional level instead.
And what do you have to do to go to the next instructional level?
You, have to master a lot of learning targets.
Cameron knows specifically what she needs to learn to move to the next grade. It's called student-centered learning. That means non-graded classrooms, differentiated instruction for each child, and an emphasis on learning through projects as opposed to textbooks and worksheets. It was the vision former Kansas City, Missouri Superintendent John Covington had for elementary schools as part of his transformation plan for the district. He piloted the project in 5 schools and then expanded it to 10 the next year. Then he took off for a job in Michigan. But many of the school's principals and teachers remained committed to the experiment, at least until the end of this last school year.
I was really eager to try something new because what we had been doing in the past obviously wasn't working. So I wanted to give it a shot.
2 years ago, Angela Underwood had just become a principal and was assigned to Faxon Elementary, a school that was being reconstituted with teachers from many other closed buildings. And she was tasked with starting this radical new program.
I actually was hired on a Friday, and the professional development started the next Monday. So I had 2 days to move all of my things out of Hartman and begin working with staff the following week.
Underwood found that for some of her teachers, project-based learning and differentiated instruction came naturally. They had basically been doing it already, even if it wasn't mandated. For others, it was hard to break away from standing at the chalkboard in front of neatly lined rows of desks. And it's a lot more work to plan 4 or 5 lessons each hour instead of just one. But with training and coaching from the district, Underwood says that teachers started to figure out how to work differently.
There were 2 teachers in particular that come to mind. It's like a light bulb went on, and I walked in the classroom, and both of their classrooms were completely transformed. It's like they just got it overnight.
Early grades teacher Christy Hodgson says there were other reasons she was skeptical. She's been teaching at the district for 14 years and has seen many programs come and go.
Honestly, I was frustrated at the beginning because we do change frequently. People want us to just stop in the middle of what we're doing and change again.
Hodgson said she was worried about maintaining discipline with the student-centered approach.
They had to convince us that you can still maintain order in a classroom and the kids learning. We were worried that the kids were going to be doing whatever they wanted all around the room and not working. But if you set the guidelines for them and if you instill in them from the beginning what is expected, our expectations, and make them accountable, then it's a no-brainer. It works every time.
Was there a moment that you realized that it was going to work?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was in a small group setting. I have 6 or 7 kids with me, and we're looking at letters and discussing the sound of the letters. And I look up, and I saw kids over in the Science Center actually drawing their pictures. And, you know, because kindergarten, we're drawing still to write at the beginning. They weren't running around and screaming. They were working, and that was when it clicked.
And Hodgson says in her class, kids are progressing faster than they did before.
I think we've seen a lot of growth in our students when we change to teaching them at their level rather than their achievement level rather than their grade level. We've achieved almost a full grade year in a little over a semester.
Principal Underwood says the academic progress has been particularly strong in the early grades. In upper grades, she says the vast majority began at least a grade level behind, but that they're improving too, according to school assessments. She'll have a better sense at the end of the school year when state test scores come out. In fact, in order to better prepare for those tests, in the middle of last year, Underwood reorganized grades 4, 5, and 6 back to the more traditional grade groups.
Yes, class.
First-year teacher Chelsea Mossman is teaching routines to her new group of 5th graders. For this reading lesson, students are in groups of 4, according to skill level, and reading from different books. The strongest reader from each group reads out loud to the others.
You will see people riding bicycles. The bicycle has become a symbol of Chinese life. The Chinese also use public transportation, such as buses and taxis.
Each group completes a chart comparing and contrasting elements of the story. One student says he's not that crazy about group work.
We didn't get to do it how we wanted to, but at least we finished.
How did you want to do it?
I wanted to be a little more neat. Because I like doing my own work individually. Because I know I'm going to get it done the way how I like it.
A lot about this kind of teaching is very common, even mainstream, throughout Kansas City area districts and around the country. UMKC education professor Etta Holland says cooperative groups, project-based learning, and differentiated instruction have all been around for a long time, though the non-graded classrooms are less common.
Those ideas, like non-graded primary, is very old, like some 40-some years old, but had been abandoned for a long time in education. That is not to say that it was not an effective approach, because I believe that it was. It is the approach that I first learned when I came into education and was a classroom teacher.
Holland says the school reforms started by Superintendent Covington have evidence backing up their effectiveness.
If schools implement those in real, authentic ways, which in many cases schools are not permitted to do. But if they can do that, then you are likely to see significant improvements in the children's learning.
Holland says state mandates in terms of testing and test preparation can get in the way of this kind of teaching. Kansas City Public School Superintendent Stephen Green agrees that state testing can be restrictive, but he says schools need to concentrate on raising scores and regaining accreditation at this point. That's why he decided to put the student-centered learning program on hold, especially the part about non-graded classrooms.
The idea of student-centered learning or standards-based instruction is something that we're still interested in as a district. The implementation of that, though, requires a certain commitment of time and resources and thorough planning. And there were questions that I had about our rush into this as I started to talk with teachers and principals throughout the course of my interim tenure as to whether or not the support system that needs to be with the teachers as they engage in that was in full effect. And then the notion that we're working as a top priority to regain our accreditation, there's only so much we could take on at any given time.
Green says the 10 student-centered schools will likely maintain some aspects of that approach, and other school principals have taken lessons from them.
The idea of individualizing and personalizing student learning is something that we've learned from that.
Green says the district will be particularly interested in seeing the progress made by students at the first 5 pilot schools, including Faxon, particularly if they return to the student-centered approach at a later date. Meanwhile, this past spring, district officials were focused on rewriting the curriculum for all schools, K-12, and aligning it with state and national standards. In charge of that project was Tiffany Anderson, who became Central Academic Officer for KCPS in January. She worked with a group of about 80 teachers on it.
Because they've had so many changes and so many changes in the focus in terms of curriculum and instruction and belief systems in terms of that, they have a variety of different, multiple different curriculum documents that either have been started partially and some have been completed with the full scope and sequence from 2005. From there, they had several other documents that were started but just weren't fully completed.
Tiffany Anderson says for a long time, district teachers had begun the school year without a curriculum document.
So when teachers return in August, they will receive a document that is the curriculum document that they can open up, and when they say, what do I teach, or what are the standards for my grade level or content area, it will be very clearly laid out for them, and as well as sample assessments and lessons. So you don't have to struggle with what do I teach and what resources do I have to do that.
Anderson says this completed curriculum is a solid step towards creating consistent instruction in the district, even while some schools are experimenting with different methods. But she herself, after just a semester in Kansas City, is headed to the St. Louis area to become a superintendent there, which of course leaves some questions about what she put into place. But she says the district has a long-term leader under Superintendent Stephen Green, and that many of the teachers and lower-level administrators are the ones who provide the real stability.
Those people who have been the stable individuals doing the work at the ground level, those individuals are still here. What's been needed is a structure and a process, and I think that piece is now in place.
Meanwhile, as everyone from parents to state legislators to the mayor has an opinion about who should be running the district, teacher Christy Hodson says she wishes people knew that every school day, the district's teachers are still trying to get the job done.
The teachers here care. They want to see these kids achieve, and we're doing the best we can with the resources we have, and we are making a difference in their lives. We are definitely pushing them to achieve higher.
Parents, teachers, and administrators are all eagerly awaiting the results of state tests that students took in April, which could foretell a lot about the district's future. They should be out in late July. Mm-hmm. Coming up, a local pastor and KCUR regular takes on a new role in his church community. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Probably the most volatile fault line in this country's shifting opinion on gay rights is in churches. Those who support gay rights and those who don't both claim that their beliefs are supported by their church's teachings. At the same time, many of the faithful are just trying to keep the issue from splintering church communities. In Parkville, these issues came up when the pastor of a Presbyterian church recently came out as gay, and he told his congregation he would be leaving to head an LGBT advocacy organization. Alex Smith has a story.
First of all, I have to make a disclosure. This story is about Brian Ellison, who's been a friend of mine and a co-worker at KCUR for several years. He formerly worked as producer for The Walt Bodine Show, and he often fills in as guest host on Up to Date. But in his real life, as he calls it, Brian is the pastor at Parkville Presbyterian Church. He's been there since 1999. Brian studied government at Harvard, but he says that while in college, he felt called to ministry. He started at the Princeton Theological Seminary in the mid-90s, just as his denomination was beginning to address the issue of gays and lesbians as pastors.
Around the time that I started seminary, the church adopted a constitutional provision that required persons who are to be ordained to be either living faithfully in marriage between a man and a woman or chastity in singleness was the language. Mm-hmm. In other words, practicing gays and lesbians could not be ordained. Now, that wasn't really a problem for me at the time because I wasn't self-aware enough to think that that applied to me.
How long was it before you realized that this position of the churches might be an issue for you that could interfere with what you were doing?
I have to admit, looking back, that by the time I was done with seminary, I realized this was a part of who I was, but I still was not willing to accept that it was going to be an issue in my ministry. So when I came to Kansas City in 1999, when I was ordained as a minister, I just assumed, I know it's crazy to say this now, it's crazy to hear myself saying it, but 13 years have gone by, I just assumed it would go away. And I know that's ridiculous to say, but I assumed something would change in me and this would never be an issue. Obviously, that wasn't the case.
So when you started at the church, did you talk to anybody about this?
No, because I was barely talking to myself about it. Mm-hmm. When I started, I was working 70, 75 hours a week at the church. I was very busy. I was new at everything. Everything was something I was learning as I went. Also, the church was growing. We were adding new members. We were undertaking long-range plans. It just wasn't something that was on my radar screen as something I needed to be thinking about. And so I didn't for a couple of years. But I got to the place where I realized I was longing for companionship. This was a part of my life that I wasn't paying attention to. And in time, I did, in fact, begin a relationship.
During the 13 years you've been at the church, I would assume that the topic of sexuality, I mean, just in general, has come up from time to time. How did you talk to people when that started to come up?
Yeah, it has come up over the years, often in the context of the Presbyterian Church nationally debating this policy that we've talked about, the ban on the ordination of gays and lesbians. So it became a very personal issue that I was, in fact, talking about in a very abstract way, in a very impersonal way. And I think I did a pretty fair job of presenting the pros and cons, the different views that are present in the church. To this day, the Presbyterian Church is not of one mind on this issue, and that includes the congregation in Parkville. There are very faithful, wonderful people who hold different views on this topic. And so I talked about it honestly, in terms of the diversity of views within the Christian church about homosexuality.
But your own personal story never came up in those kind of conversations.
You know, it really didn't. And the reason for that, Alex, is that I felt like knowing that there was this range of views and that this was a very emotional topic in the church, it wasn't part of the deal when I came in 1999. It was something that I wasn't dealing with myself. And for me to then sort of force the church to deal with that very divisive topic didn't seem fair. And I resolved at that point that if I ever did leave and move to another church, I would be open and honest about that up front, but that it wasn't really fair for me to impose it on the congregation I was serving in Parkville.
Did you have people in your church, congregants, who were openly, morally opposed to homosexuality?
Yeah, there are some members of the congregation who, who out of their faith and their biblical interpretation genuinely believe it is wrong. And they're not necessarily homophobic. They're not hateful. They just believe it's wrong and it's troubling for them. And I respect that. I love those people. I disagree with them about this. I think it is possible for a gay or lesbian person in a committed relationship to faithfully express who they are, including in a relationship with someone they love. But I guess when those people came to me with those concerns, I tried to honor, where they were coming from, even though it was sometimes personally difficult to do that. I'm thinking of a conversation I've had in the past week where a member of the church expressed to me their own sort of pain at learning that we had talked about this issue and I had not disclosed to them my own sexuality, my own sexual orientation. And I had to admit that that was incredibly painful for me as well. But given the conflict that I feared would occur in the church were I to make that an issue, I just didn't feel like I could.
You've been in a committed relationship for several years now with someone who attends the church from time to time, and I can imagine this would be sort of a tricky social situation. How do you handle having him in the church?
Yeah, it's actually a funny story. We met before he even moved to Kansas City, my partner Troy, and so he didn't start at the church, but there was a time where the church actually got a new set of handbells, and we wanted to form a handbell choir. And I was the one conducting the handbell choir because we didn't have anyone else to do it. And we were short on people. I needed people in the handbell choir. And so one day Troy said, I'll do it. And so Troy's entrance to the life of the church was being in the handbell choir that I was conducting. He's gotten to know people at the church over the years, and a handful of them knew of our relationship, but most of them didn't. That too has been an awkward thing at times. But I would say those who have known him have appreciated the ways he's been part of the church's life. And since sharing this with the congregation in the past couple of weeks, I will say that many people have sought Troy out to tell them how welcome he is there and how glad they are that he has been able to share in at least some small ways in the life of our community.
Now, since the time you've been with the Parkville Church, how has the Presbyterian Church's official position on gays and lesbians changed?
Well, the most significant change came about a year ago when the provision in our church constitution that prohibited gays and lesbians from serving openly, in fact, was removed. And so a majority of the presbyteries, that is the regional bodies around the country, voted to remove that requirement from the Book of Orders. So now presbyteries, as well as sessions, that's the church boards at the local church level, have the responsibility to examine every candidate for minister or elder or deacon and consider them case by case on whether the whole totality of who they are qualifies them for ministry and for leadership. And being gay does not prevent someone from being ordained anymore in the Presbyterian Church. No church is required to ordain gay people either, but no one will be prevented from serving just because they're gay if a presbytery or a session feels they're called.
I wonder, during your time as pastor, if you have taken any steps to try to change the church's position or, advocate for the rights of gays or lesbians as pastors in the church.
You know, although it hasn't been an issue that I have made a central focus of my ministry, there have been a couple of opportunities to speak out. Certainly when the issue has come up at our regional level, the presbytery, I have sometimes spoken in favor of changing the church constitution. I would also say recently our board of pensions that I'm a member of the board of directors of did vote to extend domestic partner benefits to same-sex partners of plan members, including clergy or whomever. And I was glad to be able to be part of the majority that voted in favor of that change.
Jumping ahead to the present, I guess the last couple weeks, you've recently decided to leave the Parkville Church. Why is that?
Well, I've accepted a new position, and I do that with great sadness in a way, because the Parkville congregation is a wonderful church full of incredibly gifted people whom I care very deeply about, a church that is committed to the community and the world. It has been a great place to serve as pastor. But I've accepted a new position as the executive director of the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. Covenant Network is an organization that has been working these past 15 years to change the church constitution to be more inclusive of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people, welcoming them into the ministry and more fully engaging their gifts in the life of the church, while at the same time preserving the unity of the church and helping the church get through this difficult debate in a way that leaves the church stronger and united on the other side. And I'm excited to be taking on leadership of that organization.
So I guess telling the congregation about this position would also make it pretty clear that you were gay. So how did you decide to break that news?
Well, although I wouldn't have necessarily had to tell them, I figured they would find out. And I wanted to honor the relationship I have with them enough to make sure that when they did hear it, they heard it from me. And so I wrote a letter. I did talk individually with some members of the church as well, but I wrote a letter that explained the sadness I had at leaving. It talked about my excitement about the new opportunity ahead, and then also shared with them that I had been in a committed relationship for the past 9 years, that I regretted having not been able to share that with them, but also that I tried to do it because I thought it was what was best for the church at the time.
How long did it take before you heard some reactions to the letter?
It was interesting. They got it on a Saturday morning, most of them, and almost instantly I started getting text messages and phone calls and emails. So it took only an hour or two after I assume it was first delivered to mailboxes. And of course, that continued all through Sunday morning when we had church. The response has been truly overwhelmingly positive and affirming. And just to be honest, I don't recall any more meaningful days of ministry than these past few days. The church has really been, for me, everything the church is supposed to be, a place of warmth and hospitality and true community, full of people who have really expressed love and care. You know, there's obviously a lot of sadness anytime a pastor tells a congregation that he or she is leaving, and I've heard a lot of that. But with regard to this new openness about my sexual orientation and about who I am, I've heard a lot of support and a lot of affirmation. And even from those who have struggled to accept that, I've heard real care for me, even in the process of them expressing their concerns. And so I'm grateful for the kind of church that Parkville is and for the kind of grace that I've experienced there.
Mm-hmm. So did you hear from people who, you know, were really upset by the news?
Yeah, I've had some of those conversations. I think sadness more than anger. But yeah, there are some folks who, and there may be others that I have not heard from, too, who are more upset. I'm trying to be in conversation with those people, trying to be caring toward them and as accepting and understanding of their perspective as I would want them to be of mine.
Now, we've seen just in these past few years what seems to be a pretty major shift in the way that the majority of Americans think about gays and lesbians. And a phrase that has become pretty popular and heard in the media a lot is evolving. What do you think of the idea of evolving viewpoints?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that the Presbyterian Church's view has evolved. And I don't think we should be surprised by that. You know, our theology, our Presbyterian theology, is that it goes back to the founding of our tradition back in Switzerland in the 16th century, around the time of the Protestant Reformation. And at that time, our tradition was called the Reformed Church. And we were called that because of a longer phrase that called us the Church Reformed and always reforming. Always being reformed, and that has never changed. That part of our identity has never changed. We have always understood ourselves to be a church where God is alive and God is bringing new understanding even to ancient scriptures. And so there was a time when our church didn't ordain women to the ministry, but we came to understand, and I think it's God working on us, the Holy Spirit working on us to help us understand that God does call women to ministry. There was a time when Presbyterians would defend slavery using Scripture. And over time, the church came to say, we no longer are going to apply Scripture that way. We think the message of the gospel is something different than that. So yes, I think our views have evolved, but I would call that God working on us and bringing us to new understandings. And I think it is right for our views to continue to open up to how God is leading us on an issue as important as this.
Brian Allison's last sermon as pastor at Parkville Presbyterian Church will be July 15th. He'll begin his new job as executive director of the Covenant Network of Presbyterians on August 1st. The organization's currently located in San Francisco, but they'll be moving here to Kansas City. Brian Allison can also be heard occasionally as guest host on Up to Date. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
We know you might not be able to listen to our whole show today, but you can catch the rest of Casey Currents online. Subscribe to our podcast on the Casey Currents page of our website, kcur.org, or find us on iTunes. Missouri's open records are effectively closed to the public. That's the opening sentence of a recent article in Missouri Watchdog. And the director of the Kansas Press Association says the same is true across the state line. But both states have open record laws, often called sunshine laws. So what is the problem? KCUR's Steve Bell reports.
In February, Michael Bushnell of Kansas City micro newspaper The Northeast News started working on the story of a proposed citywide daytime truancy curfew, and as the matter unfolded, contacted the city attorney's office with a request under the Missouri Sunshine Law.
The law department responded and said, well, we're not the custodian of those records. You'll need to talk to the IT department because you want emails. Okay, are you sure? Yes, we're sure. So early in April, I sent an email under the Missouri Sunshine Law, and I said, I'm requesting these emails that have to do with the truancy ordinance that were sent by Councilman John Sharp. And I never heard anything back. And I never heard anything back, and I never heard anything back. And I sent a subsequent email, and I never heard anything back.
Bushnell's story is not an unusual one. Open records are not fully open anywhere in Missouri. Ken Bunting, executive director of the National Freedom of Information Coalition, quotes a recent nationwide study by the Center for Public Integrity.
The Center for Public Integrity's grade gave Missouri a C- for overall accountability and an F for access to public information.
A high-profile case during Governor Matt Blunt's administration involved email messages. Before a media consortium finally got them all, the governor's office had tried claiming they were unrecoverable or not covered by the Sunshine Law and attempting to charge $23,000 to release them. Doug Anstett of the Kansas Press Association says records in that state are also far from open. He mentions the Brownback administration's asking for $1,700 for emails regarding meetings at the governor's mansion.
The problem with that is that those records are public records, should have been turned over with much less cost, you know, $100 or something for the time to look at them.
If you are wrongfully denied access to a record, you can scream, you can beg, you can holler, and then at the end of the day, you can sue. There's nothing in between.
Adds Freedom of Information advocate Ken Bunting. Bunting says he's flattered but not encouraged by the fact that the Missouri Attorney General's handbook lists him, not someone in government, as the resource people should call if they have questions about Missouri's Sunshine Law. He may have to refer such a person to the Missouri Press Association's general counsel, Gene Manicky, in Kansas City, who says taking it to court can be an expensive process.
$30,000, $50,000, $70,000, because as it goes over time, the cost gets higher and higher. The cost to file a Sunshine Law lawsuit is so cost prohibitive that unless you have a business behind you in some fashion, you simply can't afford to do it.
If you sue and win, you may get the information you sought, but you likely won't get the attorney's fees paid. And fines for violators, when levied, are a maximum of $1,000 in Missouri, $500 in Kansas, and fines at the maximum level are extremely rare. Also, you may not win, according to Manicky and Bunting, due to some other facts of life about the laws.
When you get past the flowery preamble, then comes the hundreds of exemptions. And then when you get past the hundreds of exemptions, you've got the crazy interpretations by the bureaucracy. And then you never know what the courts are going to do either.
What's needed? These experts all agree stiffer fines should be possible, maybe a category creating a criminal level of violation of the open records law. Only Florida has one. All agree with Attorney Gene Manicky, who praises states that have a public records council to advocate for citizens and news organizations.
They act as a mediator or an arbitrator. So it would give the public a less expensive mechanism to resolve those kinds of disputes, because right now private citizens almost can't afford to litigate.
But Manicky allows that the creation of a public records council or ombudsman is unlikely at a time when state governments are reducing services, not expanding them. From his office at MU Columbia, National Coalition Director Ken Bunting says the answer begins with attitudes.
I wish there was a mindset attitude with regard to public officials that recognize that the records and the instruments of government really don't belong to them. They really belong to the people they serve.
As for neighborhood newspaper publisher Michael Bushnell, he finally contacted the office of John Sharp, the city councilman who sent the emails, and was told that he can get them after they are reviewed to make sure they don't contain confidential information.
It's moot. It looks like I'll get what I need, but I don't need it anymore.
It appears that in this case, the truancy ordinance that passed in the meantime is satisfactory to most Northeast Kansas City residents. Michael Bushnell says that also is moot. Steve Bell, KCUR News.
After the break, we check out the cumbia scene in Kansas City. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, a new debate seems likely on evolution. Plans for a new terminal at the airport took a new turn, and Kansas finally got new redistricting maps for Congress, the legislature, and the State Board of Education. Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
On Monday, the Kansas Secretary of State's office did a land office business as candidates rushed to file in districts a court had finally defined only 3 days earlier. Some, like Kansas House candidate Stephen Foster of Overland Park, have never run before.
With the new district, we're all at the same starting gate, and I think I have a lot to give for it and a lot to take with me to Topeka and help our district out.
One Democrat running for the Kansas House, Larry Meeker of Lake Quivira, said the Secretary of State's office lost his paperwork. Fellow Democrat Paul Davis said he didn't suspect partisan shenanigans.
They were dealing with a very difficult situation on Monday. But the fact of the matter is they made a mistake.
The trial in the Kansas school funding lawsuit entered its second week. It was the first time anyone could remember the state of Kansas bringing in a controversial ambush journalism outfit to try to discredit a witness. The judges did not allow the edited video by Veritas to be shown in court. As the state and districts wrangled in court over funding and Kansas educators worked in a national group creating model science standards, two state Board of Education members expressed concern that the standards would give too much credibility to evolution. One was Ken Willard.
It's not a bunch of Kansas crazies that have brought this subject up. It's just a matter that it's out there, and it's much broader than just a Kansas matter. It's broader than just a national issue.
Moderates currently control the Kansas Board of Education, but with elections coming, the balance could change. A Kansas City summer tradition ended as Crown Center Square declared its fountains could no longer be used as public spray grounds. The concerns were increasing crowds and water tests that showed high bacteria levels. Aviation officials said plans for the new terminal at KCI could change. Director Mark Van Lowe said the new building might be built at the site of one of the three present terminals.
By moving this terminal from the Greenfield site to where it is, we are saving an estimated $500 million.
The new terminal won't be publicly financed, so the money-saving news did little to appease the many who would like to keep the existing airport design. Councilman Jermaine Reed, facing recall petitions gathered by people unhappy that he didn't get the city to change its plans for an East Patrol CSI lab campus, persuaded his colleagues to wait 2 weeks to vote on sending condemnation notices to the property owners who haven't come to terms on selling their property. He said progress is being made.
I have offered to provide a forum in my office to bring city staff and homeowners together for some further discussion.
Reed hopes the list of those unsigned can be reduced to 4 or 5, and those are cases where the property deeds are missing or tied up. Also on hold for 2 weeks is a plan to ease the city's billboard restrictions a little. After a lot of people, including Carol Winterode of Citizens Against Billboard Blight, testified against it.
We have a model ordinance. Other cities look up to us. We've led the way here in the state of Missouri. Let's preserve that.
The changes were proposed after owners of billboards taken for eminent domain asked prices up to $500,000, and city planners worried that litigation could slow the wheels of development. This is KCUR.
For 20 years, Shakespeare in the Park has been as much a part of Kansas City summer as the heat and humidity. And while the Heart of America's Shakespeare Festival is opening two shows in repertory this week, another Shakespeare play has snuck into town. It's the Bard's goriest play, Titus Andronicus, which is being staged with a minimal set and a band at the downtown performance space, The Living Room. Steve Walker reports.
Bloody revenge plays were all the rage in the late 16th century, and it's believed William Shakespeare wrote Titus Andronicus in order to keep up with his contemporaries. Though wildly popular in its day, it's not produced all that often today because of its graphic violence, the very reason director Kyle Hatley was drawn to it.
One of the reasons I'm attracted to doing Titus is because it is known to be the bloodiest play in Shakespeare. I love finding that sort of different layer, the different sort of interpretation on things that makes us as an audience look at things differently, including ourselves. When you look at this play, most Shakespeare plays have 5 unforgettable, memorable events in them. This play has 5 memorable, unforgettable events in every scene. And it sort of examines, in a way, I think, a kind of national anxiety, which feels awfully familiar.
Unlike Shakespeare's earlier history plays, Titus Andronicus is a tragedy comprised of fictional characters. They're warring families whose hunger for power and prestige, Hatley says, results in them doing horrible things to each other and the children caught in the crosshairs.
When we meet all of them, they're all exhausted because Rome is going through a change from a monarchy to a democracy, and it's confused by what it wants to be and what it is now and what it's going to be. We've seen their rage. We've seen their vulnerability. We've seen their confusion. We've seen all the sort of different extreme human emotions. It's fertile for human compassion. If you look at them as human beings rather than monsters, if you look at them as mothers and fathers and sons and daughters and brothers and sisters, then there's a story that adds up to something larger than families. It adds up to a nation.
Because Shakespeare plays are in the public domain, directors have the prerogative to cut or tweak the text to their will. As Hatley did for The Living Room's Carousel last summer, he's partnered again with Aaron Bates Preston, a classically trained pianist and vocalist who said at a recent rehearsal she's written nearly a dozen songs for the show inspired by Shakespeare's sonnets, including this piece based on sonnets number 12 and 71.
This is actually the piece that was pretty much the first born of all of them. This is sparked from the family relationship of Titus that I kind of felt. So it ends our act one.
I asked Preston earlier how much she had delved into the sonnets to find ones that would parallel the show's dark themes.
Obsessively, yeah. I told Kyle that he needed to stop me or I'd be writing Titus! ! So, Titus the musical. So, you know, I read all the sonnets multiple times, different versions that had different translations of what each sonnet meant. And as I, you know, kind of went through and read through the script and saw where we might have musical moments, you know, just piecing together these Shakespeare sonnets. But that was so much fun. I'm an English nerd, so I kind of have really enjoyed doing that.
The Living Room's artistic director, Rusty Sneary, said once he'd decided to stage Titus in June, his first call was to Heart of America Shakespeare Festival's director, Sidney Garrett. And all parties seemed to agree that any city with this much Shakespeare in such a contained time is more blessed than cursed. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
Titus Andronicus is playing through June 24th at the Living Room. Controlando Show is a cumbia band based out of Kansas City, Kansas. The 10-member group has been playing together under that name for the past 3 years, and they have regular gigs around town nearly every week. Controlando Show is one of 30 local bands, dance groups, and DJs, in addition to some national acts that will be playing at Fiesta KC in Crown Center next weekend. The cumbia scene is alive and well and shaken in Kansas City. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan gives us a taste. Cumbia is a style of music that originated in Colombia's Caribbean coastal region, and it's also originally the name of an African drum used to keep that ever so important beat that sparks the movement in a song. There are many variations of cumbia music, and in Kansas City, Kansas, a group called Controlando Show, whose members are originally from Mexico, are taking the musical tradition and putting their own edge and local flavor into the mix. Like this original track, Chica Que Conquista. Kansas City, Kansas is the place where the band came together and now call home, all 10 members. Daniel Rincon, Joe Sanchez, Manny Molina, Andres Suendaño, Jose Nava, Roman Valdez, Daniel Bailey, Celestino Morales, Daniel Juarez, and Ismael Garcia Jr. The group has been playing together under the name Controlando Show for the past 3 years.
Cumbia!
Like most cumbia bands, they tend to wear the same outfits when performing together on stage. One of their popular outfits sports a K and an S printed on a shirt over the heart, representing the band's name, Controlando Show, meaning more or less the ones controlling the show, but also spelling out the abbreviation for Kansas. Bassist Danielle Rincon, who helped get the group of friends together in the first place, says he likes it here in Kansas. It's easier to find work than in California, where he also lived before. Rincon and trumpet player Joe Sanchez say that they want to play all over and go on bigger tours, but having to work on top of family responsibilities and then playing in a band almost every week, if not more, takes up a lot of time. But they have fun, and the music reflects that sentiment, as do the fans who shake it at their shows. Their original track, Controlando Show, is the band's anthem. It introduces all the players and represents their home, Kansas City. Sanchez says that the hardest part is getting all 10 heads together to agree on how the songs are going to go exactly. But as you can hear, the collaboration in the end is pura cumbia de Kansas City. Para Casey Currents, soy Suzanne Hogan.
Controlando Show and a host of other local and national acts will be playing at Fiesta KC in Crown Center this weekend. You can find more information on our website, kcur.org.
Well, we thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at KC Currents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producers Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.